This is Lele Pons from Suite 305 with Lele Pons. Game day at my house, it's chaos, but like in a fun way. The TV's ready, the remotes are ready, the kids' toys are going off, and somehow everybody needs batteries at the exact same time. That's why I keep Duracell stocked. And Duracell just released limited edition Duracell and Messi battery packs. The design is inspired by Messi's iconic left leg tattoo. So every battery feels like it comes with an extra kick. From the TV remote to automatic corkscrew, Duracell keeps us game day ready. Duracell double and triple A batteries are the only ones built different with power boost ingredients for long-lasting performance you can trust. Find the limited edition Duracell and Messi batteries in stores at Lowe's and Walmart or on Amazon.
Every dating app swipe is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Moto Casino, because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them. While everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Moto Casino, the only app worth your time.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. American Social Casino.
10 hours on my feet, traffic, noise, everybody needs something from me. My head is spinning, I just need the world to stop for 1 second. But then I get home, shoes off, phone out, and I open Modo Casino. Hundreds of slots, classic table games, it's my instant reset. The variety I want in the quiet I need.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited, no purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino. America's Social Casino.
Save big money in your next painting project now at Menards. From your kitchen and bath to doors and trim and even your ceilings, Dutch Boy has the perfect finish for your painting projects. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is a tough paint and primer that provides great scrub resistance and durability. Save big on Dutch Boy paints. Plus, view our weekly flyer on Menards.com and get your painting project started today.
Save big money at Menards.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
The prosecution in the Corey Richens trial played a bombshell recording the other day. Corey Richens calling the medical examiner's office, asking detailed questions about the substances found in Eric's body. But that same witness, Dr. Eric Christensen, made damaging admissions under cross-examination. Meanwhile, the state's drug chain witnesses are contradicting each other, and no fentanyl has ever been found in the Richens home. We are going to dive into right now what is going on in the prosecution of Corey Richens, and then we'll discuss the defense of Corey Richens and how that's playing out. Joining Robin and myself, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program, is Bob Mata, defense attorney. Bob, welcome. This has been such an interesting case so far. It's had its moments, I feel like, on both sides where you go, oh, and you just kind of keep going, oh, it's back and forth quite a bit. But one of the things that we've recently seen, like I said, was that that phone call. I want to talk about that, the phone call to the medical expert, the examiner, that Dr. Eric Christensen. It was an interesting phone call. If you've not had a chance to hear it, it's obviously available out there online. And she gets into wanting to know information about, you know, exactly how much of this drug, fentanyl, killed Eric, the different types of it. At one point, she's confused about a prescription that's actually her own prescription that was in Eric's body. She can't quite pronounce it. What was your take on that phone call? Is it a big, big thing for the prosecution, or is it really kind of a nothing burger at the end of the day and just a curious wife wondering what happened to her dead husband?
Yeah, I guess the easiest way to put that is beauty's in the eye of the beholder, right? It depends on which side of the case you're on. And it, frankly, at this point, you know, I'm very big about this. Nobody should be at any point until we hear all the evidence. That's when we decide whether or not the state's met its burden. But I found it, the thing that mattered most to me, Tony and Robin, is when did the call take place? Because I was probably halfway through the testimony, and I thought Christensen was overall a phenomenal witness, not so much for either side.
I agree.
For the jury, because he was incredibly articulate about so many things that I had questions about with respect to fentanyl in general. And he was just, he was a great assistance to the jury in understanding kind of the mechanics of fentanyl and how much it takes to kill somebody and just all the ins and outs of that drug in particular. And he was very knowledgeable about the kind of the street black market fentanyl that, that was out there and was being sold a lot too. So I just thought he was very, very helpful. Now, when you kind of look at the questions from Corey's, when I find out that it's 8 months after the fact, that the call was basically as a result that they had done a supplemental autopsy report and, you know, they had added in all of the additional toxicology testing that they had done with respect to all the other fluids. And, you know, and then she gets it and she calls right away and she's just inquiring. I mean, I thought it was fair. I said, look, if I died like Eric died and my wife didn't do it, she would absolutely be calling, asking questions. You know, like I didn't think it was abnormal. Did I think it was a little bit strange that she couldn't pronounce acetaminophen? A little bit. I thought that was a little strange. Did I find it a little strange? And the script that she couldn't pronounce of whatever drug that was, I can't remember what it is, but I didn't find that as strange as her not being able to pronounce acetaminophen. I mean, the woman's got a master's degree. Like she's not yet.
You know, and Tony and Bob, to these points, and when I just listened to it last night as well, the thing that was striking me was that I Bob, you're going to see, I'm the boring one. I do all the research, you know, kind of look at trends on this thing. That phone call and the content of it actually fit the profile of what typically people do, especially as you highlighted that time removal from that. So me, she's been so compartmentalized that there's been no over the top tells of whether she's deceptive or not deceptive. And you've pointed that numerous times on this case as well, that if you're looking behaviorally, you're not getting much. So it's coming down to what you said is that reasonable doubt aspect.
Yeah. I feel like Corey is someone who is very strategically deceptive. She doesn't drop the mask all that often. You really got to kind of dig, it feels like, to get behind the mask. And then once you see what's there, you're like, oh God. And what we're seeing behind the mask is the text messages, the Google searches, those sort of things. Those are the things you're looking at going, oh God, it's the same person that's doing this? Why are you doing these searches? Why are you looking these things up? Because there really isn't a whole lot of verbal evidence in this case that really is showing her acting super strange. I mean, her behavior on the 911 call, her behavior when the police arrived, the first responders. I mean, nothing stands out as super weird. I mean, you could pick little things here and there, I guess, and say, oh, that might. But again, everybody does grieve differently. And there's nothing to me that goes way off the charts in any of those interactions as being super deceptive or strange or hiding anything, except for when you get to talking about real estate deals in the middle of your husband being zipped out and taken out of the house. But to me, that also just shows a really weird way. I mean, I guess not weird, but the way she can compartmentalize different things and handle really, I guess, multitask, if you're putting it bluntly, you know, two things at once, your husband dying and closing on a house the same day. Wow. That's multitasking. But she's able to do it, and she doesn't seem to do it with a whole lot of, I don't know, there doesn't seem to be that evil vibe that's coming off of her in those situations until you start, again, reading in a little bit deeper and seeing the searches. And that's what the prosecution came at with her with in opening, but then they're bringing it up. We're getting into the digital trail now. Just yesterday, they were talking about the memes. And I'm really curious, Bob, to get your thoughts on those memes and how damning they are. The memes where she's looking up someone wiping their nose with cash. the one that says idiots everywhere as first responders are going through her house trying to figure out what's happening. And then the I'm rich, the Trump meme that she's looking up literally as Eric's being zipped into the body bag and being taken out of the house. How are they going to explain that one away?
I thought they did an excellent job of explaining it away yesterday on cross-examination. There was no actual determination as to whether or not she even Googled those.
Okay.
So, essentially what their expert had to admit on the stand was he could not say with any kind of certainty whether or not those were things that were sent to her, whether they were things that she had looked up at a certain point in time. I mean, the bottom line is they simply, and again, the burden is entirely on the state to prove when these things happened. And, you know, I mean, what a lot of people do, and I think sometimes we're all guilty of it, but especially folks that are lay people and don't necessarily do trial work, we all tend to form a bias based on the information that we get that comes out from the state post-arrest, pre-trial. You know, and this case was one of those cases where, man, their whole theory was out there for everybody to digest for 2.5-3 years. And it's a hell of a story, you know. But in terms of those memes, to me, are they somewhat problematic? Yeah. I mean, but if I'm her attorney, do I feel like they're the death knell? No, because I thought Ramos did a very effective job in terms of pointing out the kind of the gaping holes with the Cellebrite extraction in the gray key, man. It's like he just can't pinpoint exactly when that happened. And even if they were generated from her phone initially.
Yeah.
So, you know, and like, Tony, look, man, the Google searches, I don't know if I agree with you there. I mean, to me, a bunch of them were pretty rational.
Some like, were. No, not all of them were damning. There was a handful that were very rational that I think could be explained away.
Dude, Brian Walsh is the gold standard.
That's
of
true.
Incredibly fucked up, incredibly damning consciousness of guilt Google searches. And these don't even enter the same universe as what that guy was Googling. You know what I mean? So it's like I compare it to that in terms of, do I find these to be somewhat benign in terms of context?
Yeah.
Because everything about this case is going to be context. And I would just have people wait until the defense is able to put their case in chief on and see if we get some of that context. Sure. If that context does not exist, well, then the defense and Corey Richens in particular has a very, very big problem, and she's going to be found guilty. But if they can show that there's a context in where these things might make sense, well, then like I thought it was kind of a brilliant little piece of the cross-examination yesterday when Ramos asked, I forget what the guy's name is from the whatever the forensic tech guy is.
Yeah.
And he says, are you familiar with the housewives of wherever?
Yeah.
Specifically housewives of Utah. Were you aware that one of those housewives was arrested, you know, and it happened right around when that Google search happened? To me, that's context. That's right. Like, that's probably the kind of the thing that if I was a fan of that show, that I might Google, like, oh, well, where are they going to send this woman if she isn't? So, like, because Corey couldn't have thought she was wealthy at that point. You know, I mean, yes, it could be argued that she thought that she was going to get the assets. But, I mean, if she knows Katie, and I'm talking about Eric's sister, and she does, she should have known that she was never walking into all that money without a fight. Because the probate battle in that case, which preceded this trial, is the background of everything in this case. And I have a feeling, as much as the defense can get in about that probate battle, it's going to be interesting to see.
It's also interesting, you know, and these are all, I see them as all very fair points when you take them individually, you know, because each one of these individual things can be explained away, but they're also for the jury. That's why I'm curious on your take on how you think the jury, from your experience, is going to respond to not just this one or not just this one, but their form that arc and their these wobbles of what normal people would do if they just lost a husband, even if it's someone they didn't like, because you get a cascading wobble effect of outside of what you would reasonably expect. And also, and I'm not, and I apologize for not being completely clear on this. I know the two cases on the murder trial and then the financial fraud are different. Are they able to bring in, the life insurance part as part of this? Because that to me is going to be the huge part of the rationale of this being outside the norm. And then all these things support that rationale, that outside the norm.
Yeah, I think they are in part. Like, so okay. they did sever those counts in terms right. of straight up financials. But like right now, they have the forensic accountant who was hired to kind of see what was what by Katie, the sister, in terms of the estate battle. Right. So right now we're hearing about how poorly Corey Richens ran her real estate business, mm-hmm. you know, this flipping business that she had. She was way overextended. She had balloon notes out there, which were going to come due sooner rather than later. You know, I think in her estimation, she was going in saying, well, I've got a 6-month balloon on this thing before anything's due. But when that other shoe drops, it's a hammer. You know, and if she's not able to get the houses rehabbed and flipped and sold in that period of time, it puts her in the situation that she ended up being in, which is broke and overextended and all the banks bearing down, all the contractors bearing down, all the landscapers, all the people that she was, you know, all the vendors that she was getting her materials from. She was in an absolute dire straits as far as her business goes. And, you know, I mean, you can let the bank foreclose and that takes care mm-hmm. of the property aspect of it in terms of you're not going to have to owe that money. But the vendors and the contractors, mm-hmm. they're still knocking. They still want their money.
For yeah.
the
work they
did, so. And you know, what's interesting about the fact that she's overextended is that part of that overextension is coming because she's paying like hundreds of dollars a month in premiums on life insurance policies.
Yeah.
You know, that because I looked up the numbers it would take, you know, for premiums in order to pay that monthly bill that the husband's completely unaware of for having those numbers of policies, which is ridiculous. If you're overextended, yeah. the last thing you should be doing is that.
Exactly.
Well, I think an interesting thing in this case is just how bad she was with money, how bad she was with running her business. As we know from the reports, at least from the family, Eric wasn't super down with any of what was going on. He apparently did not want to close on this house. The defense of Corey is saying they were celebrating the night before. He was excited about it. He even sent her a text that I believe he like offered to get lunch or something the day before, but she was too busy doing something else, so she didn't take him up on that. But they're trying to paint it. See, he was super excited too, even though I don't think he really was. They're painting really two different worlds, and we're going to get more into the defense in a second. But how difficult is that going to be to paint this world of, see, they were trying to work it out and be together. Meanwhile, she's like planning a vacation with her boyfriend for a month after Eric dies. She's actively, you know, talking about going, will you be my Valentine, to her boyfriend as she leaves the supposed fentanyl or drug laced sandwich in his car.
One of my Valentines.
Is that what she says?
Words matter, Tony. Yeah.
I didn't even know that. What would you be? One of my Valentines?
One of my Valentines. Yeah.
Oh, are they doing full blown like old school Mormonism here, where it's where she's taking on multiple partners or what?
I'm imagining her kids, her three boys were
meeting the other Valentines. Okay, hopefully not like although who knows? I mean,
who knows? I don't know the woman personally, so yeah. It's all speculation.
Sure, will you be one of my Valentines? So all of that being part of this, is it? It's got to be somewhat difficult to dispel this narrative of they're working on it and things are good and she's in love with her husband when she's doing all these things that clearly contradict that.
Yeah, you know. It's one of the fascinating things about trials that I always, you know, really delve into pretty deeply, especially coming from the defense side of mm-hmm. it, because the reality is that when you look at a prosecutor's job and a defense attorney's job, like we are intimately involved on a much different level with the defendant and typically their family. So we get to know a lot more of the inner workings than frankly the prosecutor ever does. Mm-hmm. A prosecutor typically has zero contact with the defendant. That person is merely what they're reading about on a piece of paper. And if they have witnesses, whatever they can glean from them. You know, so like kind of that intimate knowledge always is like what is in the back of my mind when I'm thinking about what was the reality of this relationship. Because frankly, we don't know jack shit about it.
No,
unless you were in that house, unless you were living with Corey and Eric and the kids, we don't know anything about it. I thought that that one witness who was Cody's wife, I forget what the last name was, who was Eric's business partner, she was a very brief witness, and I loved my chat because it was very telling in terms of how people viewed her. Was she helpful to the state or was she helpful to the defense? I found personally that Eric was ruling the financials in that family with an iron fist to the extent where Corey wanted to become independent financially because, you know, some testimony came out that Eric may have been having an affair prior to Corey doing it. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, there was some talk about Corey, you know, thinking about divorcing him if that turned out to be true, but being concerned with the fact that he's got all the money. I'm concerned about what that looks like to my kid. Hold on. What it looks like to my kids in terms of he's got all the four wheelers. He's got this massive estate and I'm living over here in a hovel. You know, and that's a real thing that goes on in divorces.
Yeah, I know. You
see the disparity in income between parents. So when she decides to go get her master's and get her real estate license, those things to me indicate that she was really trying her very best to become financially independent from Eric, you know, and I think that you have to factor those things in because that's a reality of the situation. And we can't pretend to know what was going on in that relationship because we just don't until we get some testimony about it. And that particular Cody's wife was the first kind of actual inside baseball that I had heard about what was going on in that relationship.
I want to say this about the iron fist. I don't know how much of an iron fist it is when she was able to siphon out hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, that's not super irony. That's kind of like balsa wood.
Well, I would disagree with you. I think the fact that she had to do that.
Does anyone have to do that? Does anyone have to siphon hundreds of thousands of dollars away from their husband's business?
Let me put it this way. If she went to him and said, look, like I need help here because I've got notes are coming due and I'm doing the best I can to get the houses flipped and get them sold, blah, 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 blah. Again, we were not in that house.
We weren't.
So like if she had the conversation with Eric and like you were saying, well, I don't think she was that happy about the big purchase. Mm-hmm. Maybe he wasn't. You know, maybe he was not down with her becoming financially independent. You know, you're jumping to a massive conclusion.
I might be, but I guess I'm just trying to look at it from that perspective of, okay, you know.
And I'm just trying to get it to look at it from the other one.
And too. I hear you. Another prism that it certainly can be looked at from. I guess the other prism I look at it from is she's insanely reckless with money, and maybe he had to be very harsh and strict with the money because he saw the way she handles it, and he'd rather not go bankrupt sometime soon. When he's been successful, he is making money. He clearly stayed married to her for all this time when he's been aware that she was siphoning money left and right. So whether he's approving it as she siphons it or not is, I guess, beyond the question, but it's happening and he's still there. I can see from another perspective too, of just like, she's reckless, she's out of control, and I'm there for the kids and I'm going to just eat this insanity because at the end of the day, it's not about the money. It's not about her real estate business. It's about my family and being there for these children. So all that be damned, I'm going to sit here. I mean, that's the other perspective I'm looking at it from.
But again, we don't know how much
we don't know, but we're also making assumptions on your point too. Well,
I'm going to the insurance. I still, you know, with the iron fist stuff, I'm doing my research on, all right, so how many times and what's the probability of multiple life insurance policies? Because that's part of their financial, you know, control that's going on. And they were done in secret. I looked up, you know, and can it even be done in secret? Technically, no, because he has to sign off on life insurance policies. He has to go for medical exam. She had fraud on that. I know it's going to be a separate thing on the other case, you know, on the financial fraud angle. But if he's got a financial fist over that, these are a lot of money and payments that are being made that he's completely unaware of. And so how much wittiness did he actually have or not have? But now, Bob, I'm on your side, you know, that deep act of empathy to understand, you know, her context of what she's trying to attempt to do. But as it looks from, you know, the confirmation bias side, when you know what she actually did with the insurance, her solution to it was to take out policies and try to knock them off. Because I looked up the probability of people taking out life insurance policies. Now, people do take out multiple life insurance policies. There's a cap on it. And you're probably a hell of a lot more aware of this than I am because I'm not on the legal side. But she exceeded the amount that's typically allowed, and it cannot be done in that kind of secret thing. And there's no reason to do it in secret unless you actually have an ulterior motive. And again, him not being aware of those payments being made, that's a lot.
Yeah. Until that comes in, I don't know how many policies she had out. Do you know offhand?
Yeah, it's like 2.something million.
And no, but like, what were the money? Like, was it?
I think it was four.
Like, what type of policies were they? Were they term or were they life? I mean, like,
I don't know the type.
It had to have been term because if it's life, you've got to, you know, if you have a life policy, they do the full medical.
I mean, I believe it could have been. I think it's even pointed out that I think some of them might have been like those ones. I believe it was even brought up by the defense where, you know, you get them like from a credit union or wherever. Sometimes you get them from some business, whatever, like we're offering a AAA. Here's a life insurance in the mail. And those are pretty simple. It's like $10,000, $100,000, sign your name and it's $4 a month. I mean, it could have been some of those too mixed in. There's just so many questions as to what, and there's still not, we don't have the full picture yet. And that's important when we're trying to break this down. Corey Richens' defense team, Kathy Nestor, Wendy Lewis, and Alex Ramos has been surgical in attacking the prosecution's case. They've exposed contradictions in witness testimony, resurfaced questions about the investigation's integrity, and highlighted critical forensic tests that were never performed. But the prosecution still has witnesses to call, and the defense hasn't even begun their own case. I'm wondering if they stole one of the things that we brought up on the show here the other week, hair follicle testing, because that was brought up as an interesting point the other day. And I think the other week when we were talking about it, why didn't anyone do hair follicle testing? Because that could really show us a track record here, because it's like rings on a tree. It would show us if he had been an active user of fentanyl for a period of time, or if this was an extreme one-off. The testing wasn't done. They made a big point of that.
I felt like Ramos was watching us.
I think there's been so many damn cases where we bring it up here and the next day it's going on out there. I do wonder about that. But it's a good point that was made, because it really could answer a lot of questions. Yeah. And for one side, it's not going to be good. We don't know which side, though, because we don't know what that test is going to show. And since it was never done, it was never ordered, along with a whole bunch of other tests that were never ordered. It's out in the ether, and the defense is using that as saying, see, you didn't test this. If you're so, you know, concerned that this is, you know, that this was something that she did, why didn't we do this test? How damaging do you think that was, or how helpful do you think that was to either side?
Well, I think that that posing the question was very helpful for the defense, because I think that's going to sit with the jurors, because I think if the point of this thing, like any trials, to get to the truth, not to secure a conviction, right? We're trying to get to the truth in these cases. And that would have been a way for them to potentially achieve that goal. Mm-hmm. Because it's not as if the state of Utah did not know what their defense was going to be.
Yeah.
This thing was highly litigated for 2.5-3 years. And I'm talking highly litigated.
Yeah.
And it was Sky Lazaro prior to Nestor and Lewis. There was a lot of pretrial motions that were filed in this thing. So there was no secret that the defense was going to be saying that, look, Eric had a drug problem, you know, and it stems from his addiction to pain pills. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it continued. And we know that there's a witness out there that's going to testify that he was a user in high school, you know, that he popped pills back then. And, you know, whether or not the jury's going to give that any weight, who knows? But
yeah,
point being is that they knew it. The state knew that this was a potential avenue for the defense to take. And for them to say, well, you know, we've got this ability to be able to test the follicles to see whether or not that holds any water, I think casts a little more shade on the state that they were afraid of getting the answer because he could turn around and bite him in the ass. Mm-hmm. Because had it come back, well, like, yeah, I mean, it shows there was fentanyl in the system. Like, even beyond February when they're claiming that she tried to poison him with the sandwich, you know, but it's like, you know, if it goes back, because I don't know. And Ramos was getting into it a little bit in terms of getting into the weeds, in terms of how far back it can go. He threw out 3 months. I had heard that it can go back a little further.
I did some research on it the other day and dug pretty deep. You could exhume him today. Could probably get fairly accurate testing that would show us definitively whether he was an active user through the course of that strand growing, basically.
Now the interesting legal question about that is, say she gets convicted, say the direct appeal fails, say they go into post-conviction act world, and that's where you can bring in newly discovered evidence.
Boom.
Now, I don't know that they would be able to argue, the defense, that is newly discovered, because they had access at the time where theoretically, you know, I mean, Nestor and look, these two attorneys have been appointed. She was found to be indigent after Lazaro left. And, you know, but you've got this situation where Nestor, if they have to go hat in hand to the court and say the county's got to pay for this testing, did they even make an attempt to do that? You know, that concept where in terms of being able to go in, newly discovered evidence is always viewed through that lens by the courts, whether or not it's actually newly discovered.
Would that be based on who's going to pay for it, though? Or like, let's say her family just says, we want to go do this testing. We'll pay for it. Then here's the results, everybody. That's new evidence. We didn't have this information before. Could we have gotten it? Sure. But the state didn't have to pay for it.
Well, that's the legal question, though.
That would be the legal. I don't know what that would be.
Yeah, because I mean, like, you go ahead, Robin.
No, I was just thinking, too. I mean, I don't like giving, you know, any bad guys, and she's not a bad person yet, you know, the intelligence to do something so premeditated. But it's interesting because if we entertain the thought experiment that he actually had a drug habit ahead of time and that this was, you know, a mistake on his part, he overdosed by mistake, and if she's any part of this, you know, it's actually trying to hide in plain sight by just exasperating something he's part of. But at the same time, though, her demeanor and her behavior of being unwitting to any of those problems is actually pretty congruent with if he did have a drug problem, she was not aware of it. But it would make sense if she was. But here's the counter to this again, getting all these different little data points to analyze this on is, if she thought that actually was a defense, why wouldn't she press for the hair follicles being tested?
Right.
I mean, I would. I mean, seriously. I mean, so here you are. You're her, and you do a great job of being her family in those shoes from the defense angles. And if you think this is a possibility to exonerate you or explain away what happened, why wouldn't you make a full court press, even to the press, saying to do this?
100%.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
It's that thing where, you know, that you'll see sometimes in cases where neither side necessarily wants to know the answer.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like we had it in Richard Allen where DNA that was an unknown male profile and neither side did anything with it. And it was blowing my mind because I was saying the same thing. I'm like, if I'm Allen, if I didn't do it, I'm screaming at my attorneys, why aren't you testing that unknown male profile? Because I guarantee you it ain't mine.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like, this is a little more far afield than that. But I mean, it's a legitimate question.
Just think about all the blind spots that would answer by just testing the hair follicle. And I'll tell you, I'm with you. You know, Dr. Christensen did an amazing job. Great on job. That. And here's one, you know, it's actually, you know, on the behavior side of things, here's why I thought he did an amazing job. Besides the facts, the details, his presentation, when you listen to that call, you heard his level of care and professionalism when he said, it's no problem at all. Call me anytime. That was someone who's about his business, very pragmatic, very, very, very objective with delivering bad news. And I mean, he was so well presented, both himself and the content. And I thought he did a decent job of talking about this with his limited resources and limited things he did have, you know, between what was in his stomach, what's not in his stomach, and then the mix of the other compound in there and how this fell right in between, whether it was an addict or not an addict, a one time off. It really is too bad they didn't do that hair follicle. Wish they should.
I know. And I mean, it was one of those things. I just thought he was. And I said it during our live, I'm like, for Corey Rishens to be able to call the office of the medical examiner, and we're talking about the medical examiner in Utah, and get him on the phone was amazing to me. Yeah. I can't believe she got him on the phone.
I know. Well, what about just the modality of doing that? That's an interesting thing to do. Are you calling the medical? I mean, it's if we're normal. Just thinking in normal, I know it is normal, but if you are... If you are concerned that, let's just put it in the perspective of where she might have been sitting at that moment in time. If you're concerned that someone may be looking at you for suspected murder of your husband, are you going to be raising your hand in any way, shape, or form to ask questions and get on the radar of anything?
Yes. Would you? Remember, this is 8 months in, and the probate battle, Tony, I highly recommend you dig into some of those pleadings, man. Okay. The family and Corey were at war.
Okay, so that's why she was doing that. Okay, that's what I'm trying to understand. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just trying to go, why is she doing it? Like, what's the modality? Why is she making this phone call? Because to me, it's like, if you're trying to stay off the radar or something, I don't know that I'd be making the phone call. I don't know that I'd be raising my hand if I did it.
Nah.
I'm saying if I did it. I'm saying that's like, for in the Corey camp of that actually points to more innocence than it does guilt. I
agree, you know, but frankly, either way.
Yeah.
You know, I hear what you're saying. And logically that makes sense that if she did do it, you'd think that you wouldn't touch that with a 1,000,000-foot pole. You could obviously make the other argument that, well, I'm going to do it. Yeah. So it makes me look like I'm just curious what's going on. Cause I know the family thinks that I killed him.
I might not also write a children's book about it either if I don't want attention at me. And so clearly
she's doing research for the book. Yeah. She wants to be accurate.
Clearly having attention at her wasn't a problem. She was all good with that, no matter how you splice it. And if we look at it this way or that way or this personality or that type of personality, you know, it can go down different paths. Go ahead, Robin.
I did look up, typical calls that are made to medical examiners, the typical questions that are asked. And she was really in the ballpark, and that goes to what you both your points earlier on. Her ability, whether she did or not, to compartmentalize is really, really strong, and everything she's doing is pretty congruent with what you'd expect her to do. But it's so easy to have her confirmation bias one side or the other. But it was within the norm.
Let's talk about the drugs that were procured by Corey from person to person to person to person. It's not really up for debate here that she procured drugs. That I think is well established. The evidence is there. The texts are there. The chain is there. It's more so a question of what did she procure? What did she think she was getting? And if you take the name of the drug out of this whole equation, which seems to be the big thing everyone's arguing in court, is the semantics of, well, is it fentanyl or not? Because he died of fentanyl. Well, guess what? In all of the communications, nobody's talking about fentanyl, but it also they're talking about shit they don't know what they're talking about either. You have Corey asking for propofol, basically, but she just describes it as the Michael Jackson stuff. She doesn't ask for it by name. She just wants the something even stronger, as she puts it. At the end of the day, does it matter what they all called it? Because I don't think any of them were either in the right mindset to know what the hell they were dealing with or getting. they were street drug deal. It was from a street drug dealer who also admitted on the stand that, yeah, guess what? Fentanyl's laced into a lot of this shit too. I didn't specifically sell fentanyl. I didn't think I was selling fentanyl, but it turns out a lot of the stuff over here called Oxy is actually fentanyl. So that's in the mix. Does it matter? Does it matter that Corey didn't know it was fentanyl? Does it matter that the dealer didn't know it was fentanyl? But at the end of the day, it looks like somebody mixed some fentanyl into the Oxy and then it ended up in his system. Does the semantics matter other than trying to confuse a jury, which I get, that's the strategy here. But at the end of the day, she wanted the stronger stuff. She got stronger stuff. Does it matter what it truly is or if she knew what it truly was?
Yes, of course.
How? Okay.
It's aggravated murder requires, it's a very specific statute in, you know, you and I talk about this all the time. The state has to prove each and every element mm-hmm. of that statute. And if you pull that statute up, it has to be intentionally or knowingly procuring. And they're going under the poison statute is what I call it. In terms of she has to know, just getting some shit off the streets ain't it.
Well, but she's asking for it as the Michael Jackson stuff.
Bullshit. The Propofol. Like people keep saying that it was a cocktail. It wasn't just that. It was
no
benzos, dude. It wasn't.
No, I'm asking because she asked for the Michael Jackson. She wants the Michael Jackson stuff, is what she said. Allegedly,
if you believe Carmen.
Okay, so that's the allegation she asked for. Basically, when someone is asking for the Michael Jackson stuff, it's not they're going to ask for stuff that's going to make them go open up an amusement park in their backyard. It's shit that's going to kill them.
That's not what killed him. It was a cocktail of benzos and
but she asked for stronger stuff for that purpose. So does it again? It's. Does it matter if she even knows what the hell it is? She's asking for something that's going to kill her husband, basically.
I don't construe it that way.
How do you not?
Because Propofol is not what killed him. It was
it's not.
It's like saying, like, I want the Matthew Perry drug.
But you then somebody's like, I'll give you shit that kills you. And whatever it is,
it's not going to kill you. Like fentanyl is a fucking poison, man.
It is. But she didn't know what she was talking about. She was asking for something to kill her husband with.
Let's go to intent. What's the intent of her?
Purpose? That's the perp. Yeah,
that's but that is what the state has to prove.
Right? Yeah.
And that's why it has to be. Because, look, in 2022, we all were hearing about everybody. If you were paying any attention at all to what was going on in the world, everyone was dying from this fentanyl that was being like introduced into the black market drug market. Mm-hmm. And like, so in my world, the intent, which has to be intentional or knowing, it right. can't be, I just need some shit. I want enough Roxy 30s that I'm going to crush 70 of them up.
But that's not what
shit.
She said. She asked for the Michael Jackson.
That's not what, like, you're taking what Carmen said, who I did not find to be a credible witness,
okay.
as gospel. I mean, okay. if you're going to give that the weight, then give it the weight. But okay. to me, the Michael Jackson drug, I had to Google it. I had to Google and yeah. see what the
and
Michael
I know,
Jackson
I know she didn't
drug.
Get Propofol. I know she, and you couldn't get Propofol. Nobody's like dealing Propofol on the street.
I want to go back to the intent, Bob.
Yeah.
So what I'm curious about on the defense side is so – I think everyone's saying that that there was a purchase of drugs, correct?
Yeah,
that,
all right. 100%, right.
So now defense has to, what do you think defense is going to do to show her the intent she had in the purchase? That's what
they don't have to do anything. You know that, Robin. What is the state going to do to prove that was her intent? Because what the defense is going to argue
right.
is that he had an addiction problem and that he was the one asking her to procure. He had an addiction to pain pills.
But she didn't say that, though. I mean, so that's what I mean. So in order for the defense to use that she procured it for him, she'd have to say, I procured it for him because he's got an addiction problem. Is that what you think she's going to say?
Theoretically, if she takes a stand. Like, I mean, the problem for her is the walk the dog letter.
Right.
So many landmines for her to take the stand.
Right.
It's, you know, like.
And that's why I thought that's why, you know, and I get Tony's point on this as well. It's like, it doesn't matter what they bought. She had an intent to get this. And so if the intent wasn't murder or the intent wasn't to give it to him without his wittiness, what was the intent?
But that's the state's burden to prove entirely.
Yeah, but still the jury's going to hear it.
But yeah, they're going to hear it, but the state has to prove that her specific intent. So right. Aggravated felony or aggravated murder is a specific intent.
Right, right. I understand.
Can't be, you know, well, maybe like if he has too much, he died. It had to be, I'm procuring a poison, which I know will kill him. And then so I used it to kill him.
So again, my question is this, how do you, because again, this is not my area when dealing in the courtroom, obviously, you know, so then how do you present that and the instructions you give to the jury to not then make that leap that, you know, so she bought it. We definitely confirm she bought the drugs and that and these are illegal drugs or whatever they are. And you can't come to any conclusion because the prosecution didn't do it right, that she bought them to give to her husband. I mean, how do you, what kind of instructions came to do a jury to not make that leap on their own?
I mean, in terms of the instructions, they're going to get whatever instructions they use in Utah. You know, they're pattern jury instructions that they use. So they'll use the instruction that they give to every jury in every homicide case. So whatever that is, and I haven't pulled it up yet on our feed, like we do that close towards the end of trial, but whatever it's going to be is it's going to say that they have to prove each and every element. They're going to say that she had to knowingly or intentionally, and it's either or, had to procure something that she knew was going to kill her husband and that was her intent. Kill her husband.
Right,
so
right.
The problem for the state here is the investigation was so shitty.
Right, right.
The common theme that we see through case after case case after case, because, you know, you have the first cop who walks in and she tells the story about the Moscow mule, yet this cop doesn't see fit to say, all right, I'm going to go look in the sink to see if the cups are there. I'm going to look at the bedstead. Because like Robin, right. I have to think as a former FBI guy, you get a guy who's saying, you get anybody who's saying that to you in their initial interview, the first things they're saying to you, you're like, okay, well,
take that.
Like let's start looking around for these cups.
Right.
You know, where are those cups? Like, I'm not accusing you of anything, but what exactly did you serve them the drink in? Oh, well, you know, the copper mugs that you serve Moscow mules in. And where are those? Oh, those are in the sink. I'm gonna go ahead and grab those. You know, put my gloves on, drop them into an evidence bag, and we're gonna test those to see if we can find any trace of ethanol or fentanyl, rather. And you know, because it was interesting in terms of his blood when they did the testing on the blood, they found no alcohol in the blood.
Right, right, right.
They found ethanol in the body, but as Christensen said, the body produces ethanol and it produces it from all kinds of things.
Yep.
So that's not indicative of the fact that he had the alcohol in his body. So it doesn't corroborate what the state's theory is that she dosed the fentanyl
or
dosed the drink. I mean, so it's challenging for the state, man. It really is because of the gaping holes in the investigation on the front end. It goes to what you were saying earlier, Robin, which is this is going to be death by 1,000 paper cuts for them.
Yeah.
It's going to create this arc where either the jury's going to buy the narrative what the state has created, because the state wasn't there, just like the defense was there. Nobody really knows what happened. Like all that we can do as attorneys on both sides is take the evidence and craft a theory based on what we believe might have happened. And we'd go and try to sell that to the jury. And whichever side sells it more authentically to the jury, to where the jury's like, I just can't overlook that fact. And yes, it's all circumstantial, but it all makes sense to me. And typically the way that it works in this country, that defendant in that chair gets convicted.
I got one follow-up to this, Tony. I'm sorry.
No, you're good.
Taking time. So Bob, so you know how to connect with the defense a lot. You know, you're working with these families. I mean, so put on your theory hat. What do you think, you know, might have been going through her mind to purchase those drugs?
Well, if I'm Corey, and it goes back to that question, how do I get it in? Right. If I'm Corey, I'm saying Eric had a drug problem and Eric had asked me to procure them. And you can't even show that I went to the house to pick them up, that it was Eric. He asked me to call Carmen because I knew from my relationship with her over the years that she had an addiction problem. And, you know, I knew that she had access to a dealer because that's how she was getting her drugs. And so I hit her up at the behest of my husband because he wanted these pills. You know, I mean, the other part of it where, you know, I don't know if the defense is going to take the walk the dog strategy wherein they're going to say that he was procuring these drugs through some cartel slash rancher at some place down in Mexico that he went to. I have no idea. I mean, to me, the safer argument that I'm trying to make if I'm the defense is that Eric had a pill problem, which then still goes back
to the
issue of why didn't we test the hair follicle?
Yeah.
Because it either proves or disproves that theory immediately. It's a fascinating case, man. It
really could they admit anything like that at this point in the trial? If somebody said, let's go get a fucking hair.
I think if neither side were to object to it, potentially, because it's so late in the game.
Yeah, bro. Yeah.
It's so late in the game, and I don't know how long that testing takes. And
yeah.
Look, we saw it in, frankly, I you know how I always go back to Richard Allen, but we had the hair that was wrapped around Abby's finger. There was a female hair, which they didn't fucking test for 7 years.
Only thing going on, Richard Allen, man. You and me, all of us are on the same sheet. That was
they didn't get the results until trial had started.
Yeah. They would tell us so much, and maybe that's just the card that Corey's going to keep in her back pocket if she gets convicted, and maybe it can be an appellate issue. Maybe, who knows?
We'll see.
But it won't
be on direct appeal. It'll have to be post conviction. You're stuck to the record. You know, only the things that happen at trial and pretrial for your direct appeal. When she loses that, which I'm sure she would. You know, ultimately, that's where you get into that post conviction. That's where you go after ineffective assistance of counsel claims, as well as, you know, newly discovered evidence. And then your battle is it newly discovered? You had access to that evidence at the time going into trial. Why didn't you test it?
Yeah.
You know, because that's what I'm saying.
Sure.
The defense had the ability to go to the judge and say, Judge, I'm on bended knee here. My client's indigent. Mm-hmm. We want to get this hair tested because we feel that it's potentially exculpatory to our client. Yeah. And the judge is probably going to say, all right, I'm going to give you some county funds. Have at it. So see how it plays out.
Would be very interesting. Your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube and our Substack. Love to get you weighing in on the Corey Richens trial. Let's go over to another case that just wrapped up. Closing arguments have finished, and now a verdict is in. Literally, right as we're jumping on the air here today, Colin Gray has been found guilty. After 2 weeks of testimony, one defense witness, the defendant himself, and now a jury has decided that the father does bear criminal responsibility for his son's rampage at Appalachie High. Bob Mata is with us to discuss. Bob, I know you've been covering this over on your channel at Defense Diaries. This is a big deal. I have not even seen a headline on it yet. Robin just mentioned that he was found guilty as we went on the air. Bob, how has this played out, and what does this mean for the future?
This case, Tony, would have been the one time, because I'm not built to be a prosecutor. It's just not in my DNA.
Mm-hmm.
This would have been the one case, along with the Crumblies, where I would have donned the white hat and sought to convict this guy. Because to me, it changes the game. I mean, obviously, there's an aspect of the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms and the right to own guns. But to me, it's much bigger than that. To me, this case was always about neglect. It was always about enabling that child who he knew or should have known was going through some serious mental issues. And ultimately, he ignored it. And ultimately, that resulted in two children and two teachers dying that day, that awful day at Appalachie High School. And, you know, if you watch that trial and it starts to become obvious what he knew and yet did nothing. And I'm not, because you can make the argument if he had just kept the gun in a gun safe, we're not at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, you know, what's to say that he doesn't procure a gun somewhere else and goes and does it. If that's the case, dad's not on the hook, you know? And here's the thing in terms of what he was charged with, which makes it so significant, is that it was second degree murder in stark comparison what the Crumbleys were charged and convicted of, which was involuntary manslaughter, very different, mm-hmm. right? Because there's an intent factor, but the way that it operates in Georgia is there's a predicate charge, which is the cruelty to children, that has to be proven first in order for the jury to get to second degree murder. And a lot of states don't have that operation of law where it's even available to them. I tend to think that a lot of state legislatures are going to now enact that so that they can mimic exactly what Georgia did here in terms of holding parents accountable. And I get the argument. I see it all day in my chat, and I love the debate. I love the debate. Is it a bridge too far? Did they go too far? This is ridiculous. Should it apply to gang members when parents know that their kid's a gangbanger and they're going out and they're doing drive-by shootings? Should those parents be accountable? Will they be accountable? And the answer to that is maybe. And ultimately, what should give us all the ability to breathe easy is that it's always going to be 12 citizens that sit in that jury box that are going to be the arbiter of that decision. It's not going to be the statute and the government aren't the issue in terms of how that law or those laws are going to be applied moving forward to parents. It's ultimately going to be the fact finders, which are going to be the juries all across this country, because it's high time. I've got four kids. I can't imagine what it would be like going into school where I used to have to go in and worry about, we're doing a tornado drill today. In case we get a tornado, you're going to hide under your desk. But my kids have to go through active shooter drills. We live in a very, very different world and one that I'm not happy with, because no one's doing anything.
Yeah.
And these are the first two things that I've seen anybody do. I tip my hat to every prosecutor that has had the balls to move forward on these charges. And it's because, look, we all know prosecutors that's an elected office. It's a political office, and they're taking a huge risk in terms of trying these cases, and they're doing it for the betterment of our country, for the betterment of our children moving forward. And I'll tell you right here, I'm here for it. I would have found him absolutely guilty because he neglected the shit out of that kid.
100%.
He knew. He should have known that AR-15 was leaned against this kid's wall.
Yeah.
He walked into that bedroom and saw his shrine to Nicholas Cruz, who was the Parkland school shooter who killed 17 people. And he asked him, who is that? Is that a boy band guy? No, Dad, that's a school shooter who killed all the kids at Parkland. The dad knew. He did nothing about it. He's directly responsible for that kid going into that school and doing what he did, because he could have stopped it.
You can't be willfully ignorant as a parent anymore is really what this shows. And he took the stand. He didn't have to. And he just showed what a dipshit he is. Even on the stand, it felt like he was trying to bullshit his way through why he wasn't present in his child's life. And at the end of the day, that's what I really got out of it. This guy was completely not present in his kid's life, even though he was there and he pretended to be. And then he acted, well, I'm just being a new dad. I'm being this. And like, really? How are you this stupid? I mean, he is stupid without a doubt. This guy is not a genius. No. I don't think he really would qualify to work at a closed down family video or a Blockbuster for that matter. But the thing is, this is just such obvious shit that he completely ignored, willfully ignored, because I don't know if he just didn't want to deal with it. I don't know what the hell his motive was for not taking any sort of action here, but he just turned an absolute blind eye to his son. And all, I mean, you couldn't get a more obvious, predictable school shooter than this kid. And to sit there and be like, do you think he had an anger issue? I don't know if it was an anger issue. He was questioned so many times on the stand. Do you think your son had an anger issue? And he walked around that every which way possible. Clearly the kid had an anger issue. And this really has finally shown us no more. No more bullshit, no more lies, no more you being ignorant. Guess what? You are accountable, and guess what? That person in your house, until they're the age of 18, you're responsible for them. So you better buckle up and get your shit together.
That's right.
Thank God we got this verdict.
Every parent in this country is now on notice.
Good.
Now you know.
And there's not one kid yet that has done one of these things that hasn't had red flags. Every single case of a school shooter has had red flags, some more than others. Some where parents did try a little bit, but then we're willfully ignorant. But this one was so over the top. And to your point earlier, Bob, it was a great point. You know, you're always going to have that jury of 12. You know, so reasonableness comes in. So if you have a kid that is a gangbanger doing a similar things, but then you can, their parents can show, we did this, we did this, we did this, we did this, it did this, and we still failed, then the jury gets to decide, did you do enough, you know, to mitigate that? And he just went off the rails and he ran away from home and everything. So that's going to be a different situation, especially if they called law enforcement and you actually did all you could to mitigate it ahead of time and it still failed. But at the same time, though, this kid was screaming.
And that's a point.
I know we're on a rant on this one. How often is it that someone is so screaming for help and no one gives it to them? It brings you to tears to even think about, you know, yeah, this kid made a choice to take lives, but you have this overwhelming sense of loss for him because no one was there. A dad wasn't there to keep him from his worst self. Mm-hmm. You know, so yes, he should be fucking behind jail forever.
Fucking man. And look, Robin, you have kids.
Oh yeah.
Tony, I can guarantee you not one of the three of us would ever have a school shooter come out of our house. I guarantee it. I am. And I'm not a helicopter parent by any stretch, but what I am is I'm hyper vigilant about what's going on in my kids' lives. I can sense immediately if there is something wrong with one of my kids. If my daughter walks in the door from school and she doesn't have her normal face, I'm like, what's up, girl? Come talk to me. It's about communication with your children. It's about being involved with your children. If you see red flag, this fucking guy, like when his wife tells him, and look, she was a nightmare as well. Okay. Mm-hmm. Like this kid, I feel great empathy for Colt in terms of that kid moved, 7 times in 4 years. That kid didn't go to school his entire 8th grade year. And again, that enabling and what his father decides to do to try to quell the problem is buy him a fucking AR-15 because he thinks that, oh, that'll make him happy. So when you have the local law enforcement who has been contacted by the feds to say, hey, you know, we got some intel that this kid over here in Athens, his Discord is showing that somebody's posting about, you know, shooting up a school. And then they come over and fucking talk to him with both of them out on the front porch there. And I don't give a shit if law enforcement followed up or not. Mm-hmm. He's on notice at that point. If you're not having a detailed conversation, if you're not taking your kid's computer and seeing what you can see, I don't give a shit if you're a tech moron. You're going to try to figure it out. I want to know because if you're going to buy that my kid said somebody hacked my shit, that's on you.
I got a buddy of mine, close friends, and his son was having a hard time in high school. Not even close to this, but he was given signs of what I call a wobble or a tremor in the force. My buddy told his supervisor, and this was a bureau guy, that I'm taking a month off, and I am at home. So screw you, to reassign all my cases. My son needs me, and I'm taking a month off.
Love it.
I've had earlier in my daughter's life, you know, we've had boyfriends break up because you see wobbles and tremors in the force, man. You got to step in.
And
it comes down to simple things. It's not about good people, bad people. No, it's unhealthy. You know, when you see something unhealthy, an unhealthy relationship, and to your point also, Bob, is communication. If I am not creating an environment where I can have open, honest communication with my kids, it's on me. 100%. And if they're not communicating with me, we gotta reset right now because shit's crazy because they're going to get that validation they need somewhere. They're going to get that dopamine hit either through talking to you or shooting a gun, and you don't want it on the gun side.
Oh, dude.
The only thing in this case that, and I'm happy with the verdict, 1,000%, but what does concern me is, okay, we now clearly have a precedent set here for future parents. Let's predict there's the next father here like this, the next guy that's going to have the kid that's going to be doing this or woman, whatever.
the authorities did warn them. The authorities came and said, there's problems here. So this isn't a case where there wasn't see something, say something, and we're warning the family and the parents. It was relying on the parents to do something. And at home, I mean, that really should be where this happens. It should be addressed at home. But the thing is, Colin didn't do, he didn't not do that. I don't think he was mentally capable, honestly, of doing. He's an idiot. He should have done something more, but he did not. So we're continually still relying on bad parents to make good choices at the end of this. Does this, at the end of the day, change that? Obviously, you know, we've had punishment for things forever, and hopefully that deters people from making bad choices. Is this going to fix the already idiotic parents that are out there? Does this move the needle at all in terms of slowing down the school shooters that are out there that have the clear warnings because the parents could be held more responsible? Or do we still need to take a closer look here when you have the FBI involved, when you have the local authorities all screaming, there's a problem here and mom and dad aren't doing shit? Do we need more levers to pull and not solely rely on the parents to do their damn job? Because clearly they're not.
Well, here's what I'll say about it. And, you know, if you have designs to kill, like say you're a serial killer,
mm-hmm. yeah,
the fact that there's a death penalty in your state matters not. It's no deterrent.
Yep.
Here the difference is that as these prosecutions and convictions start to mount, it's not the parent that is the actor, mm-hmm. right? So it's different. So as these start to mount and as parents become more and more aware of the fact that parents are being charged for actions their children are taking outside of their presence, I think it will have an impact.
Yep.
How many of these cases it's going to take before people pull their head out of their asses, I don't know.
Yeah.
But what I can tell you is it's certainly not going to hurt the situation.
No.
I only see positives coming from it. If it stops one school shooting,
sure,
then it's starting to work. Then it's done its job. If it saves one kid's life, one teacher's life, anybody in that school, then in my estimation, it was worth it. And moving forward, we can only hope that, because look, I mean, look, we have to get a fucking driver's license. We had to take a course. We had to go test on the road. Any asshole can become a parent. Mm-hmm. That, like, and there's nothing that's ever going to change that. There's never going to be a law unless we're going to become communist China and say, you know, if you have more than one kid,
sure,
like we're not doing that. So mm-hmm. the reality of the situation is anybody's going to be able to have kids, mm-hmm. and we're going to have to figure out ways such as this that we can mitigate what the hell is going on out there. Because frankly, you know, when you get into the Second Amendment side of it and you talk about the gun lobby, it's powerful. And mm-hmm. you know, the Second Amendment is important. And don't ever forget that the real reason that the Second Amendment came into place was so that we can protect ourselves from our government.
Mm-hmm.
God, you know, God forbid, if the shit goes down, we need to be able to protect ourselves from them, as everything in the Constitution is our protection as citizens. It's not for the government,
mm-hmm.
or the government to be put on notice. You can't do this to us, the citizens. And man, you know, like in my world, the more the merrier. And you just need to understand, if your child has done this, they're coming sniffing, they're coming and digging. And you know what? They need to.
Robin, I'll give you the last word on this. What say you?
Yeah, I think it's going to have also a lasting impact, not just on the parents. It's a warning for them, but also I think it's going to, you know, the whole bystander effect is going to hit it as well. I think neighbors are going to be more aware. So again, thought experiment. So you see a neighbor's kid having some hard times, something that people kind of do a little bit of, but maybe we're going to do a little bit more of now, is like, what's going on in that house? What are the parents doing or not doing about this? Should I say something? Should a teacher say something? Should a counselor say something? I think it puts people on a more higher alert, not just parents, but people in this, you know, in one degree of separation to say, should I do something? You know, one of the things I've been doing on the outside, you know, there's all these hotlines. There's a new hotline that just came up for red flags, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you see something, there's actually a number to call for red flags. And so I think hopefully it'll have a bigger effect for, you know, we are our brother's keeper in this, not just the parents of the kids, but you know, let's take
all village.
More, takes a little bit more responsibility. You've got to get a little bit more out of your comfort zone. But if you see a kid on a bad path, an unhealthy path, a potentially destructive path, and you see absentee parents, fucking say something.
100%, man.
It is certainly a step in the right direction. We have many more to go, but it is certainly finally one in the right direction. Your thoughts in the comment section, let us know. Substack and YouTube, the links are in the description. We will continue our conversation there. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're getting podcasts so you don't miss any of our coverage of this and the many cases here. Be sure to check out Bob's podcast, Defense Diaries, wherever you get podcasts, and on YouTube as well. And Robin Drake, obviously, as well. He's obviously with us every single day now. But check out his stuff too, his books, wherever you get books. Sizing People Up, a great one, a good read. I'm in it right now. And there's also pre-orders right now on It's Not All About Me, available wherever books are sold. Go check all that out. All right, gentlemen, as always, thank you for being here. Until next time, we'll continue our conversation in the comment section. I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Every dating app swipe is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Moto Casino, because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them. While everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Moto Casino, the only app worth your time.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino. Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily, and the best part, guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.